This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up and down these Michigan roads, yeah.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Baby, I'm home.
Well, thank you so much, Parker, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. And as y'all have come to expect from me on this podcast, we are pleased to welcome yet another of the biggest names in the blues to our show today. Traditional blues, it has been said, is born out of struggles, poverty, loss, sadness. It's all part of the blues genre, and this artist knows all of these on a close personal level. Beginning at the age of only 7, this Tyler, Texas native started singing and playing drums at his church, and he was off to the races and on his way. Sadly, his mother, who struggled to raise 3 boys on her own, was diagnosed with cancer and passed away, leaving the boys to be raised by their grandmother. As an adult, our guest served in the United States Marine Corps for 10 years. He is a Grammy-nominated singer and songwriter, the 2019 and 2020 Soul Blues Male Artist of the Year, and B.B. King Entertainer of the Year. He also has won the 2022 BMA for Soul Blues Album of the Year. His new album, Human Decency, is looking to be another big one for our guest, 40 Below recording artist Sugar Ray Rayford. Welcome to Time Signatures. How are you?
I'm good, brother. Thank you for having me here, and thank you for taking the time. I truly appreciate it. And hi to all your fans out there.
Well, we are certainly happy to have you here, and we're going to kick right off and get things rolling. But I want to begin, Sugar, with thanking you from the bottom of my heart for your 10 years of service in the United States Marine Corps. Well done, sir. You have my deepest appreciation.
You do what you can. You know, it's weird. I always tell people, you know, I didn't join out of some great patriotic thing. You know, a lot of my family has served. I just remember being,
yes, sir,
getting ready to turn 18 years old with no prospects. And I figured, I was like, well, at least if I joined the military, and I knew I was going to be the Marine Corps because most of my family has been Marine Corps, a couple Army and maybe one Navy. But I was like, at least I knew I'd get 3 hots and a cot and a chance to get out of the country and go see something. And once I actually got there, I enjoyed the Marine Corps. So I stayed until my son was born. And that was the reason that I got out. But yeah, I'm
awesome.
Proud to have served and just proud to be a veteran.
Excellent. Thank you again. Now, I want to talk to you about your diving into the music industry and starting to get things rolling. Where did that journey begin for you? I know that you had your background in gospel, but when you started breaking out, how did that process evolve?
It was really strange because it wasn't a coherent thing. It was more like, you know, I was bouncing for a long time. I was a cooler, had a few clubs and bouncers working for me, and it was live music being used. And, you know, I enjoyed watching the guy, believe it or not, I enjoyed watching the guy set up. I enjoyed them watching them play and watching people's reaction to it in between me having to throw people out or deal with other things. But it was amazing. And, you know, I had met my now wife at that time, just acquaintance. I had met her daughter before her daughter and some friends. And then one night she came in, and one of the nights that she came, for some reason, the band that was up there singing, for some reason the singer, I don't know what happened, I walked by the stage and they gave me the mic, you know. And I said this a million times, that it doesn't matter where I know the words or not, a melody is a melody is a melody. And I had many years of training, so I just made up something, had fun with it, and people were kind of shocked because they were just like, what the heck, you know, you're the bouncer, you know, you're not supposed to be able to sing and perform. Pam, my wife, at that time, my friend, she was just like, you know, you should do this. And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, you lit up the room, your entire soul lit up. You could see it. And, you know, you were put on this earth to do this. And I remember saying, like, yeah, that's fun, but you can't make a living. I got a child to feed and a home and all this sort of thing. So that was the beginning. And from there to the Urban Gypsies a few months later, and my first show was a big corporate show for Coca-Cola. That was my very first show. It was a corporate show for Coca-Cola. I was in a top 40 cover band, the Urban Gypsies, and that did really, really well in the San Diego area and playing at the Belly Up. We opened for Parliament. We opened for Dennis. We opened for Dennis Quaid and the Sharks and a few others. And I loved it. I mean, I was like, man, this is great, you know. And at that time, I was still bouncing, and I had the ranch and the avocado ranch and all that. And I remember Pam saying, you know, you should, you got to make up your mind, you know, are you going to do this or is it just a hobby? And I was like, you know what? I'm willing to give it a shot. And she was like, well, I got your back. Let's do it. And so did that for a while. But then I realized the guys that were playing with me, they were happy with just doing the cover stuff. And, you know, a lot of them were big name guys. And they've been in the music for a long time. James East, the brother of Nathan East from Clapton. Michael Mose, who used to be with Parliament. Martin Grease from Mad Dogs and the Englishmen. And Charlie George from Verdi Bird and all that. So all these major guys, Monette Marino, and her father one time took Pam and I to lunch, and he wanted to tell me, like, you know, you can do this. You should really start doing your own music and go out there and push. And I was like, well, I love the blues. I said, it's the closest thing to gospel. He said, you should give this a shot. And Jim Marino was one of the original Ink Spots. So every once in a while he would come sit in and play with us. So it's been weird. Yeah. It's been weird. My whole career has been surrounded by people that I knew but didn't know who they were, and they always encouraged me and pushed me. And so that's how I wound up leaving my own band and joining the Unkissed Boys and coming into the blues world. We're both swinging.
Now, you left the Urban Gypsies and you found a new home with Unkissed Boys, a Temecula area blues band. So would it be safe to say that all through the AKB that you found your place in the blues? And talk about that second place finish at the 2006 IBC while you were with them.
Well, I did. That band, man, they were already like an 8-9-piece band when I joined. So they were already a band. So what wound up happening is I've now left the Urban Gypsies because I wanted more. I wanted to write. I wanted to go in more to the blues world than so much the soul world at that time. And so Pam found a jam in Temecula. We were living in Fallbrook. We had a 5-6-acre avocado ranch at the time. So I was an avocado rancher. And she found this jam in Temecula, and as Pam always done, she signed me up, and like, we're going out somewhere, and I would never know. I'd get there, and the next thing I know, somebody called my name. Now, by this time, people in San Diego knew who I was because the Urban Gypsy Band was one of the top corporate bands there.
Sure.
And they saw us playing the Belly Up and a bunch of the name venues at the time, San Diego. But in the blues world, nobody knew me from Adam. So I went to this little, I can't remember the name of the club, I went to this little club to sit in, and it had gotten a reputation of having a great jam. And so I went in there to sit in, and I'm very high energy, and I'm shaking it, and I'm singing, and I'm having a good time. And a lot of people usually can't keep up, but this drummer that was playing that night, that guy was amazing. His name was Dwayne Hathorn. And I was just like, man, this guy got my energy on the drums. You know, he plays like the guys I grew up with in church and blah, 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 blah. And unbeknownst to me, after that we did a few songs, that night, Dwayne called his guitarist, Jimmy King, and said, hey, man, I found this guy named Sugar. You got to check this guy out. So I go back the next week, and then Jimmy King, the guitarist from Unkissed Boys, is there, and Dwayne. And we have a rip-roaring time, and, you know, I'm only supposed to do one song, but I think they wind up letting me play for like 45, 50 minutes, and my repertoire isn't that big, but I'm just having fun. The next thing I know, literally probably a week later, I get a call from those guys. They were doing a big show up in Idlewild, the Idlewild Jazz Festival. And they were like, you know, they had another brother that was a lead singer on keyboards. And they like, we want you to come in and sit in. I'm like, man, I didn't want to cause any problems, man. It was enjoying myself. They're like, no problem. Come sit in and blah, blah. Well, I was nervous as all get out because there's all these black people here. And I hadn't sang and like, you know, I hadn't done blues, you know, gospel. And I was really nervous about getting up because, you know, black folks gonna tell you. You know, white folks are kind of, they won't say very much, they just keep it on the breath. Black folks gonna come up and tell you whether you should be doing this or not doing this. So it's kind of nerve-wracking to perform in front of the brothers and sisters. But it went over well. And the next thing I know, probably a week or so after that, they wind up reforming the band and getting rid of the other guy and a couple other people and asked me to join that band. And from there, we just started running, man. And at one point, we were doing probably 150, 160 shows a year, playing all the casinos. I mean, just crazy amount of gigs. And we wind up winning the RBC, which was the Rhythm and Blues Challenge in L.A. for a bunch of soul bands, but we got invited. And we went up there and did our thing, and we actually won that, the Lamb Jam, the Los Angeles Music Network, blah, blah, blah. You know, people there from Arista Records, Enterprise, all these big labels, the big name labels at the time, and they, all the A&R people, and they voted us as the winner. And we wound up getting a distribution deal from RBC Records. Nothing ever really came of it, you know, but we wound up getting a distribution deal from them off the spot. Later, we found out about the IBC and the whole challenge thing. And so we had people in Temecula, Fallbrook, and Northern San Diego County saying, you know, you guys should go down to San Diego, the San Diego Blues Lovers United, and get into this challenge. And if you win, you know, you go to Memphis and blah, 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 blah. And, now all this is new to me because I literally only been doing blues now for about a year and a half. So next thing I know, we win the Blues Lovers United San Diego challenge. We win that thing by a landslide. And the next thing I know, we're in Memphis for the International Blues Challenge. So now all of a sudden I'm in Memphis. Last time I had been in Memphis had been probably 25 years. I used to be there every year for the National Convocation for the Church of God of Christ. That's where they hold it. Okay. And I'm like, this is a whole different thing there because this is blues, this ain't gospel. And we run around Memphis and everything, and we're doing all the, it's like a week-long process, you know, bands from all over the world. And you play like two or three venues and you get voted and you move on to the next venue. Next thing we know, we're in the finals. And wow. We're at the New Daisy Theater in Memphis. And, you know, we just go in there and with no plans or nothing, we just go in there and be ourselves. And we go in there and we destroy the thing. There was a lot of controversy. I think we were beat out by a gentleman by the name of Joey Gilmore, but we found out later there was a lot of stuff that was going on behind the scenes that Joey had won the year before, but then the second place winner brought up something that he had a record deal and he was disqualified. Mm. And you got to remember during this time, the blues thing had been on a lull. You know how the blues boys get hot, then it get cold. So they hadn't had a lot of really, really great bands that had come through. So no one expected Aunt Kizzy's boy. So they basically had already set it up that it's going to give Joey first place to replace it from his disqualification and second place and blah, 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 blah. And then we showed up, which kind of threw a kink in everything. But we wound up getting second place. And I know, I remember there was a big controversy because the Memphis Sun-Times ran a front page ad the next day. And it was like, Joey Gilmore wins IBC with a question mark. There was a small picture of him and a big picture of us on the front page. And I was just like, oh, crap, you know, I just came to do my thing. And that was the beginning of it. And from there, we started playing across the country and going to Europe and stuff like that. And even with Aunt Kizzy's, it finally got to a point where I realized, again, that I wanted more. I wanted to reach out bigger and everything. And turmoil in life. We had sold the ranch. We now moving to, the family had closed a private practice and we were now moving to LA. And that's kind of where everything just kind of blew up from there.
Well, you are watching and listening to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. And I've got Sugar Ray Rayford coming to us live from all the way down in Texas. You can tell because he's wearing a cowboy hat. Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about that in just a couple of minutes. I promise you, absolutely going to be talking about that. We want to talk about 2011. You joined the Manish Boys. You won some recognition there. But it was really your move in 2013 where you launched out into your solo career, yeah?
Yeah, you know, I never gave up on my own band. I formed my own band. After leaving Aunt Kizzy's Boys, I formed the band. It was called Sugar Ray and the CK All-Stars, my buddy Chuck Kavoras. And, you know, not to go too deep, but there was a lot of stuff that happened in there. I wound up running the top jam, pro jam, in L.A., which was a big deal. And so I would have the big guys, you know, the Steve Lukathers, the Slashes, the Vivian Campbells. It's also where I met Mike Finnegan. It's also where I met and became friends with Al Cooper and Honey Boy Edwards and so many other big name and people that was outside the blues, like Lifehouse and the Pussycat Dolls and a lot of stars and stuff started showing up there. And so one night I get a call from my good friend who just passed away a few years ago, the legendary Mr. Cal David. And I love Cal. He was always good people to me. I met him back when he still owned the Blue Guitar in Palm Springs. Anyway, I'm sitting there in L.A. I get a call from Cal, said, hey, man, me and Jimmy Pavino are playing over this place at the Maui Sugar Mill. Why don't you come through and sing a few songs? I'm like, all right, man, cool. I'll come through. I'm doing nothing anyway. And so I go through there, and it's you know, it's Mr. Gadsden and James Gadsden and Nate Watts. And that was another thing, too. And I'm sorry, because I'm trying to put a lot of stuff in a short period of time.
You're doing great, man.
My first band in L.A. was called the Invitation All-Stars. Remember, I come out of the gospel world, military. I don't know anyone, so I just treat everyone like gold. And it wound up being the best thing for me because that's who I am. And so the Invitation All-Stars was Gerald Johnson, the original bass player for the Steve Miller Band, the brother with left-handed upside-down bass. He was on bass. The legendary James Gadsden on the drums. And this guy named Adam Stark on guitar. It was a three-piece and me singing. And Adam Stark wound up being, like, I think, the vice president of Pixar, but this is way before that.
Okay.
We were playing small venues around L.A., and it was weird because I would see all these movie stars and stuff that would be showing up, and I was like, well, I know they're not showing up for me. They don't know me from Adam. What's going on? And so this is before Google was big and before YouTube was big, and most of the stuff was Wikipedia. And so Pam went home and started looking up the guys we were playing with, and I was just kind of flabbergasted. I had no idea that I was playing with all these legendary guys. They were just righteous, down-to-earth people. And so because of all these different connections through the L.A. area, I ended up in the Mouth of Sugar Man with Jimmy Vivino from the Tonight Show, from the Conan O'Brien Show to the Tonight Show, I think it was. Not Conan O'Brien Show, I think it was the Tonight Show. I can't remember. And Jimmy Vivino and Cal David and those great guys there. And then there was this little guy, I thought he was Australian, playing harmonica, who was really throwing down with us that night. Later on, I remember standing outside with Cal David. And Cal was laughing at me because he was like, you have no idea who that is on harmonica, right? And I'm like, no. I said, but you know, he's a pretty good player. He's all right. You know, I'm not the biggest harmonica fan, but this guy, I said, he knew not when to play and when to play and blah, blah, blah. And Cal's just laughing his butt off. Yeah, come to find out, you know, and I'm like, why are you laughing at me, Cal? Because I knew I done stepped in it again. And come to find out, the harmonica player was John Mayall. So that night it was me, John Mayall, Cal David, Jimmy Vivino, Nate Watts, James Gadsden. Unbeknownst to me, Randy Sharkoff, the president of Delta Groove Records, who had already been a judge for me in IBC the year or so before, he was there that night. Three nights later, I get a call from my producer at the time, Chuck Avoris, which is why we always call the band Sugar Ray and the CK All-Stars. Chuck called me and said, hey, man, I got this call from this Randy Sharkoff guy from Delta Groove. One of his singers, a guy named Bobby Jones, has left the band and moved to Vegas, and they're reviewed, and they got this big, big show in Spain, and he saw you the other night. He wants you to come, one of you will come and sing and learn these songs, and you're leaving in 48 hours. So I was like, well, you know, man, I got nothing else going on. You know, this is cool. I talked to Pam, like, before I could even say anything, she had told him, like, yeah, he'll do it. And next thing I know, I'm on a plane trying to learn songs, and there's video out there. I land in Hondarribia, Spain. We do, like, a little hotel room, in the hotel room, rehearsal. No real instrument, just going over songs. And find out later that it wasn't even really the managed boy. It was Kid Ramos, Willie J. Campbell. Jimmy Bott wasn't there. It was J.R. Lozano on the drums and Sean Pittman instead of his regular. But I remember walking out and the legendary Mr. Finest tabs me, and I'm the opening guy. So I remember walking out on the stage, 90,000 people. That's the longest crowd I had ever played to. There's video of it. 90,000 people. I'm playing with a band that I never even rehearsed with. I don't know these guys. And, you know, but I was like, you know what? I'm here now. I may as well just be myself and do what I can do. And so I had fun with it, enjoyed it, threw down, great show. On the flight back, Randy Sharkoff asked me if I wanted to join the managed boys. I didn't know who the managed boys were from Adam at that time. Sure. And so I wound up joining the managed boys. And with a short period of time, I wound up being the closing act, but Finest opened it for me. And it really circumvented many years of me in the blues world because the managed boys had such a name. They only played big festivals that all of a sudden, I come into the blues world and people knew who I was because all of a sudden there I was with, fronting the managed boys, this legendary band with all these legendary guys, you know, Johnny Dyer and Leon Blue and Kid Ramos and Kirk Fletcher and Frank Goldwasser and Jimmy Bott, all these names. And that opened up everything for me. But in between that, I always kept my band going. even though Randy was always trying to get me to get rid of my band, I just had an innate thing that I did not want to be, quote unquote, under somebody's thumb my entire career. I wanted to leave myself options. So I was still doing shows with my band. And so when Chuck finally convinced me to do my solo album, Blind Alley, we actually had like 15 original songs we was going to put on that album. But because I knew all these big rock guys that played with me on the Monday Night Jam, when they found out I was doing an album, they all wanted to play on my album. So I don't know if you ever go through the album Blind Alley. I don't think I have a copy in here with me, but if you ever go through that, you would see people like, there's a version of Death Letter on there. It's me and Brian Head, who at that time was the drummer of Foreigner, Tim Bogert from Bogert Baker Peace from Vanilla Fudge is playing bass, me singing, and I forget who was playing guitar. There are some of the guys from Guns N' Roses like Slash and a few of those guys on some of the songs. Mr. Gatson is on the songs, Albino Bennett, all these big name rock and soul guys. So it wind up, I think we wind up putting one original songs on there and wind up putting all these covers. So my first solo album wind up being an album that I didn't intend to make, but it came out the way it was. But it's like all these big name guys on this album. They all came in and played for free. They just wanted to play.
You know, wow.
J.T. Thomas from Three Dog Night, blah, blah, blah. I can't remember everybody. It's been a long time. And so that was my first solo album.
Now, your new CD, Human Decency, has already received critical acclaim. The content of this album reminds me of a style very similar to that of Taranzo Cannon, who, as you know, is very, very much about speaking his mind. And yeah. And as you touch on today's socio-political themes, but you do so with honesty and, as you say, with love in your heart. Talk about this album for a moment.
Well, you know, with all this craziness going on, all this division, I've been saying it for a few years now. When I met Eric Corn, I had just come off a world tour, and I was in Memphis, and I was getting ready to go, and I had been invited to come into the Orpheum Theater to play with Del Toro Richardson, and I remember standing on the corner in a suit and everything, but I was literally exhausted. I had just did 6 months world tour, and I'd been home for like 18 hours, landed in Memphis, met my wife, and so met Eric Corn there. And I had just finished the album with the Daptones and the Italian Royal Family in Italy called The World That We Live In. And most people, you may not know the Daptones, but they were Amy Winehouse's band. But before they were Amy Winehouse's band, they were Sharon Jones's band. And those guys were really, really nice, the bass player and whatnot. And through some collabs with him and Lucas Sapio, we did The World We Live In. And I loved that direction of what we were talking about. And like I said, you know, like anything, you grow. And I finally had gotten to a stage in my life where I had things I wanted to say, figuring out how to say them. But I say all that to say, all this division we have lost in America. We used to have this thing of civility.
Yes, sir.
And
yes, sir.
We have lost civility. And what I mean by that, and I tell people, you get 20 people together, no one's ever going to totally agree with anything. But we used to have the civility to sit down and listen to one another's arguments. That's what made America great. It was the sum of all the parts. For some reason, we know that it's corporate greed, and people try to put it on racism and all this other stuff. And I always tell people, not that there isn't racism, but racism is just what it is. It's ignorance. There's only one color in America, and that color is green. If you got green, it doesn't matter if you're black, purple, or you got three titties with a horn in your back, it doesn't matter. If you got green, you in the in crowd. If you don't have green, you're not in the in crowd.
Right.
And they have definitely made sure that all the tribes keep fighting each other while they can keep putting their hand in the pot and do what they want to do.
So yes, sir.
Since I've been with 40 Below, Eric Corn and I, our entire thought process has been, we want to uncover the things that are being done and said and bring it to the masses, but we had to do it in a way where you can't just give people vinegar. So we put the vinegar in sugar water, and the sugar water is great sounds and great rhythms and great, you know, drum sounds and, you know, West Indies horns and all this great stuff. But if you stop and listen to what I'm singing about, it's very, very, very serious. And so Human Decency is the culmination of those years. This is the third album, and we're just not pulling any punches, you know. But my thing is, I want to be able to tell you the truth the way I see it, But at the same time, I'm not trying to make division. I want you to know that, yeah, I see what's going on, but that really got nothing to do with you and I. You know, let's shake hands. Let's be two human beings, two Americans, two Europeans, whatever. We're just human beings, regardless of your color, your religion, or your political aspiration. We're still human beings. We still eat crap, poop, put our clothes on one leg at a time. So let's. My whole goal is, yeah, I'm going to talk about the hypocrisy, but at the same time, I'm also the same guy that if you fell down, I'm gonna reach over and help you up, because beyond all that other crap, we're still human beings, and we've really lost stability in this country. I can't talk about other countries. I live in this country. I've served this country, and we have lost civility. That civility was something that we always had in this country. It didn't matter if you was from New York, California, Texas, Maine. You know, you knew that people would be civil to you. You know, you could have a discussion, not so much even an argument. You could have a discussion with someone who was Republican, this guy was Democrat, or that guy was independent, and you would leave that discussion usually with a chain of thought like, okay, well, you know, I understand where he's coming from now. I understand where I'm coming from now. I know why I believe what I believe. But that didn't mean anything. He may have been a Republican, he may have been a Democrat, but he was an American, and we've lost that. That kind of like the thing growing up you with your family. Yeah, you can fight with your family all day long, but if somebody else outside your family fight them, then they got to fight us all, because that's civility, and we've lost that. We've really lost that.
Well, Sugar, it has been a whirlwind interview with you so far. Where can people go to find out more about you, maybe buy a CD or some merchandise, or most importantly, where can they go to book you?
Oh, man. I'm booked through Intrepid Artists International down in North Carolina. Those guys are great, Rick Booth and all those guys, Jake and all them. You can book me through that. You can go to my website at sugarrayrayford.com. With one R, SUGARAY, Rayford, RAYFORD.com. Same with the Facebook is at The Sugar Ray Rayford. Instagram is Sugar Ray Rayford. TikTok, Twitter, X, all that is all Sugar Ray Rayford. You can go pick that up, and it has all my dates and where I'm playing and what's going on. We have the new album comes out June the 14th, but you can pre-order it right now. This is the new album. I literally got it yesterday. It's one of the best looking albums I think I've ever done. I want to say a big thank you to Alex Walsh and Eric Korn. They did a great job with this. It's so warm and so beautiful inside and outside. So yeah, everything's at sugarrayrayford.com, and you can go find out where I'm playing. You can buy an album. You can also go to 40belowrecords.com. Eric Korn, I want to give him a big shout. He's such a wordsmith. He is so, I could talk to him and he comes up with these words, and it's exactly what I was trying to say. Some people just built born to do that. I call him a wordsmith, and he's done a great job in crafting these songs for me to sing. So, and I want to say thank you to you and to all your listeners for allowing me to get up here and ramble on the way I have. So thank you very much.
Well, Sugar Ray Rayford, a huge thanks for being my guest today on Time Signatures, man. I wish you continued success, and we are genuinely hoping to get you into the state of Michigan soon. And to you, my viewers, my listeners, my followers and fans, thank you for being here, because without you, none of this would be possible. If you would like to be so kind, you make sure you go down below and click the subscribe and notify button so that you don't miss an episode. Jim Irvin reminding you that keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time, that's my mission. Until next time, so long.
God bless. Peace.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on cabs, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Baby, I'm home.
Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC Connect. Voices.
Vibes. Vision. K-12 Operations at Lansing Community College is a proud collaborator of the Mason Promise Scholarship. The Mason Promise Scholarship is a community organization of volunteers that guarantees funding for 2 years of Lansing Community College education to selected Mason Public School students. For more information on the Mason Promise Scholarship at LCC, please visit lcc.edu/hope.
Keep yourself connected with what's happening in Mid-Michigan by joining us for Community Convos, a show from LCC Connect, where we talk with the people who put the festive in our festivals and those that give traction to our attractions. Find out who's on the convo and listen on demand at lccconnect.org.
Do you worry about how much someone else drinks? Do you ever ride in a car with a driver who has been drinking? Do you think if the drinker stopped drinking, your other problems would be solved? Al-Anon family groups are for relatives and friends who have been affected by someone else's drinking. In Al-Anon, people who have experienced the same kind of chaos and confusion in their lives will share what works for them. They will offer suggestions and support without telling anyone what to do. There is anonymity, confidentiality, and safety in Al-Anon family groups, and there is hope for a peaceful way of life. Are you troubled by someone else's drinking? You might be surprised at what you could learn in an Al-Anon family group from people just like you. For more information, go to alanon.org or call 1-888-4-ALANON to find an Al-Anon meeting near you.
LCC Youth Summer Camp registration is going on now. View all summer camps and register at lcc.edu/seriousfun. These day camps range from exploring Michigan wildlife to battling robots to stop motion animation. There's something to match every student's interest in grades 2 through 12. Register soon at lcc.edu/seriousfun. Camps fill quickly.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
Welcome to a psychodelicious conversation on mental health issues and trends from two local mental health professionals in the greater Lansing area. I'm Michael Stratton, LMSW.
And I'm Morgan Bowen, DNP, PMHNP, and we're here to provide you with a deep dive into the human experience of consciousness and beyond. Our aim is to be educational and entertaining, so just kick back and open your ears and your minds.
Hey, I'm Mike Stratton.
And I'm Morgan Bowen.
And we are here to talk about treatment of cannabis issues. If you have not listened to the first part of this two-part episode, please do so because it's going to help you. It'll help you inform you as to what we're talking about. Yeah.
So yes. I was just thinking, you know, with treatment of cannabis, I mean, you know, with alcohol use disorder, opiate use disorder, we have, you know, from a psychiatry standpoint, you know, medications that we use, but we don't have a lot for cannabis, at least in terms of a medication approach. And in fact, I've worked in detox centers when I was a nurse, and some of them won't have a person who's addicted to cannabis come to the detox because there's not a sense that there's not a need for like an acute detox, that it's you just have to stop smoking pot.
Mm, it's interesting.
I don't necessarily agree with that, but yeah, it kind of has its own. It's a unique approach.
When I was using a lot of it, my approach for quitting was to drink more, which is not advisable.
No. Yeah, that's the replacement. That's a replacement theory.
Yeah, you become cross dependent. So when I'm working with somebody who presents where that could be an issue, there's really two parts to this. One is to do that assessment of just like, what's your relationship with it like? You know, what is your relationship? How strong is that relationship? And sometimes when they see how strong it is, they say, well, I don't want it to be that strong. I don't want it to be that important to me in my life. The second part of the conversation then is, do you want to do anything about it or not? Mm-hmm. So when I talk to someone about it, I'll say, first of all, what do you like about it? You know, let's make a list of all the things you like about it. And there's usually a lot of things. And when I was using, there was a lot of things I liked about it. I felt like it expanded my consciousness a little bit. Like I could understand beat poetry. I could understand jazz better than I could before. I could understand existential philosophy.
Really deep thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, there were a lot of things that I really enjoyed about it. And it's good to get all of that stuff down when someone is describing what they like best about it, because those things will be key. If they do try to stop it at some point, you're going to have to fill in the blank for them.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so if you're one metaphor I use is if you have a toolkit and okay, what's in your toolkit? Well, I have a hammer, I have a screwdriver, I have a wrench, I have a few other items, and all of a sudden that toolkit's gone. Well, you got to figure out a way to replace a hammer and a screwdriver and a wrench. You know, so how am I going to get to sleep? How am I going to relax? How am I going to hang out with my friends? How am I going to handle it when I have a problem? How am I going to, you know, whatever it is that they put in that like column, you're going to have to eventually find a way to address that. And that's where CBT stuff comes in. But then the other is, once they talk about what they like, they're a lot more open to talking about what they don't like about it. And that's important too, because those are the reasons that would motivate them to quit or to cut down. And that's the other two-part question. You know, how motivated are you to quit on a scale of 1 to 10? And how motivated are you to cut down on a scale of 1 to 10? Some people are absolutely convinced they want to quit. More often than not, they want to control their use. They want to see if they can control it and cut it back, cut it down.
Yeah. So, and that kind of speaks to, you know, from a professional perspective, like an abstinence model where it's like, you know, you want to remove the substance, stay away from the substance, not have it at all, versus a harm reduction model where you want to, you know, reduce the amount that you're exposed to the substance. And so, you know, we've wrestled with that idea in treatment, like, you know, and I think now we're much more open to the idea of harm reduction, whereas I would say, you know, historically abstinence was the focus.
Years ago in the substance abuse field, if someone wasn't ready to quit, they would say, come back when you're ready to quit.
Right. Yeah.
And that was unfortunate because people would have to go out and get a lot more consequences to their use, you know, which were sometimes legal, sometimes relationships, sometimes medical, and they'd come back and then they were ready to quit because they'd lost so much. And what they've come to find out with, it does matter. Prochaska and DiClemente came up with a model of change. It wasn't a model of change and no change. They broke it down into five separate stages that someone could be, and I'll go through those quickly. Pre-contemplation, where you're not thinking about changing. You don't feel like you have to change.
Solid no.
Yeah. Contemplation is maybe I do need to quit, but I'm not quite ready, but I think about it from time to time, your contemplation. And then the next one is decision or preparation. Is a part of the decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where you've decided that you are going to quit or you are even going to reduce. And also then action is the fourth stage, where you're taking the action to actually quit. And then fifth is maintenance, where you maintain the change that you've made. And weirdly, with those five, sometimes I'll talk to people that are using and are completely uninterested in quitting. We'll do the same five stages to change of how did you start to use. You know, because there was a time when you never thought you were going to use marijuana, you know, when you were really young. And when did you start thinking maybe you would, and how did that happen, and what's, you know, so they explore their whole arc of their relationship with it. And sometimes that's interesting to people too, especially if they, you know, want to know for sure that you're not going to try to argue them out of it, because they really feel like that's their fear.
Well, I think it's important for us not, you know, so I shouldn't say struggle, but when I am working with a patient, it kind of depends on the setting, because I do work in substance use treatment where, you know, the idea is somebody's come, you know, is somebody has a problem, they've identified that they already have a problem with it, so now we're doing something about it. But if I'm working with somebody more in my outpatient practice who is, you know, in a pre-contemplation or contemplation phase, I don't necessarily want to develop the idea that they have a problem with, you know, cannabis right off the bat when I don't totally know exactly. Because people in a clinical setting will reveal themselves as they become more comfortable with you, as they work with you more. So keeping that open mind about – you know, okay, some of this stuff is, some of the things that you're telling me seem to be, you know, red flags or indication, this is my thinking, but I as the clinician, I'm going to keep an open mind here to kind of really explore and understand your usage pattern. Because not everybody is, I mean, nobody's the same.
No, and what I said in the first section of this, there's a lot of people that are very successful who use cannabis pretty regularly. And I have clients on my caseload right now who use regularly, sometimes even heavily, and they don't present it as an issue.
Same.
They are, you know, talking about a relationship. They're talking about something else they're trying to get to in their life, you know, something different than that. So it's not a focus, you know, it's not,
yeah.
If it's not a problem, it's not a problem. So, and it might be, you know, sometimes you do that thing where you say, well, you know, some studies show that some people that are struggling with getting to their goals, that amotivational complex, you know, where they just can't get motivated, might be linked to heavy cannabis use. What do you think of that? And if they pick it up, you know, it's like, say, well, okay, I'll look into that, or I'll think about it, or let's talk more about that. Or they might say, no, that's not it.
Yeah. Nope.
No, this is a big no.
No. One of the things from a medication standpoint is there can be interactions between cannabis and medications that somebody has taken.
What are the ones?
Well, we don't know a huge amount of the scope of the interactions because there's just not a huge amount of studies on them. So it's very unpredictable. I actually have people sign a disclaimer, everybody that I see, that if you do use cannabis, I can't guarantee what would happen combining cannabis with the medications. It's not going to be toxic. It's not going to be deadly, but it could impact the efficacy of them. One thing is metabolizing medications, just the way that your body does it, is impacted by both tobacco use and marijuana. Mm. And so, you know, it can impact the levels of the medication. So what is standardized in FDA trials is we expect, you know, this dosage of medication to provide this effect. But if you have other, you know, substances in your body, that can impact the levels. And so we can't, you know, we're kind of working on an uneven playing field.
So the way that you ingest it, would that make a difference, smoking versus having edibles?
It's really about the amount that's in your system.
Okay.
Yeah.
We didn't even talk about edibles in that first chunk.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's all sorts of, and that's one of the, you know, that's one of the things that we can't, you know, with drug testing. You know, I don't routinely drug test people, but there are some situations in which I will want somebody to do a drug test. And, you know, if they've talked about smoking cannabis and it shows up in the urine drug screen, then that's not a huge surprise. But I do like to know kind of the extent, you know, like we talked about, there having a lot of marijuana or cannabis in your system, is potentially much more impactful for medication maintenance than, you know, somebody who's a light smoker or just a casual smoker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So the, you know, once someone has actually stopped, the next step is to, you know, try to do some of that replacement of the tools that's in their kit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Some of that is the CBT stuff, which is cognitive behavioral therapy. Of just simple problem-solving skills. What would you do? You know, let's name some things in your life that could go wrong. What would you do if that happened? Who would you call? How would you handle that? Let's make a plan. Let's make some plans of things that you can anticipate. You know, like you have a big fight with a good friend, or you have someone on a podcast who keeps calling you old. what are you going to do about that? And so somebody, you know, would get a chance to actually explore what things would be like for them.
Another is to manage cravings, if there is cravings.
Yes.
So I was thinking about smoking pot while watching movies, smoking pot while playing video games, you know, as a heightening to a sensory experience is kind of a common combo. So then if somebody really loves playing video games, how are you going to play video games not smoking weed or, you know, ingesting cannabis? And the same with like Netflix movies, stuff like that.
Yeah, I talk about triggers with people and talk about triggers being in two basic flavors, you know, external and internal. The external is, oh my gosh, every time I hear Jimi Hendrix, or every time I go by this corner, or every time I see so-and-so, because they're always, they're the ones who always have the marijuana. You know, there are certain things that can trigger that. And then the internal are emotional states. And all of us are more comfortable with certain emotions than we are with other emotions. And to know, you know, what emotional states are really difficult for me. So when I first stopped using everything, and I was talking to a therapist about it, and the therapist asked me at one point, they said, what do you do when you get angry? And I said, I don't get angry. I didn't think I got angry. And what do you do when you get scared? And I thought, I don't get scared either. And I just had no idea how much of that was bubbling under the surface for me, you know. So being able to get in touch with those different emotional states and getting comfortable with them is an important thing, and a long-term kind of work to do, you know, to get in touch with that stuff.
It's true. It's true. You know, a lot of times people will say that they use drugs. I'm trying to think of how to, you know, use a substance to help to know themselves better. It opens up parts of them that, you know, maybe they felt like they couldn't connect with. But then there can be, you know, kind of the flip where it's like the you know, from the outside, it seems that the person feels very uncomfortable when they don't have the substance. Like they, as somebody without, you know, the substance in their system, who are they? What, you know, what would their life be like? And so that cultivating the idea that somebody can live and be happy or enjoy movies or do things, you know, without the substance, helping to bolster that belief that they really can live without the substance, I think is a big deal with cannabis, especially if somebody's using daily. You know, it's pretty much in their system all the time.
Yeah, when I was getting trained to intervene with teenagers with this, and one of the things you ask is when someone stopped, you just ask, you know, what is it that you've noticed this week? And I remember this 15-year-old guy who just said, life is really weird. It's really weird. And he just kept emphasizing how different life seemed. It was almost like life was a distortion without cannabis. So it was just such a different experience for him. And then we've also commented about sleep, how difficult sleep is, because so many people use it in the evening, you know, to relax and to get to sleep. And so the idea of what do you do now to relax? What do you do to wind down?
And there's most likely going to be a difficult period when, if the person totally stops using, you know, there is going to be discomfort or a adjustment to biorhythms, to, you know, all sorts of things, appetite, sleep. And so there is an adjustment period, and that is uncomfortable for people. And so, you know, we as clinicians often spend time talking about the benefits that will happen when the substance is, you know, when you're able to reduce or stop the substance. And then you see them the next time and they say, my life is terrible. I can't sleep. Everybody's weird. You told me this was going to be good, and it's not. So how do we deal with that, Michael?
Well, first of all, you normalize it. You normalize it, that it's not easy at first, and that it will get better over time. And some of it, too, you know, who's in your social circle and who's in your inside circle? You know, there's a whole set of things that I do about that. But the ability to tolerate emotional states is so much of it. And helping people to be on top of their anxiety through breathing exercises, through helping them know, you know, cognitively what is it that they're thinking about, almost always catastrophic ideas about what's going to be in the future, or romantic ideas about what was in the past.
Yeah.
So when they think about their use and they're loving it, usually they're thinking about really, really enjoyable periods of time when they were using, as opposed to, oh, geez, I was using around the clock. Oh, that's right. I've spent 5 years doing this same thing in this dead-end job. You know, they're not thinking of that. They're thinking about what it was like when it was really, really good. So helping them differentiate some of those things. And a lot of this stuff at this point is just really good psychotherapy, good counseling techniques. You know, a lot of it is listening to the person telling their story about what it's like for them and where are their struggles, and also what's working for them, what went well this week, and can we build on that? Because it's not usually all bad. It's some good things. So
yeah, good points. I find some of the hardest times, you know, speaking about, you know, kind of what sort of social circumstances are you in? I mean, for some people that, you know, I've met with, and I think a lot of people out there, you know, marijuana is just part of their life. It's part of their family, you know, their parents or their siblings or their spouse or their, you know, I mean, it's just, it's you know, very similar to alcohol. It's just always present. It's always there. And to, if you're interested in trying to make a change within that, that can be very difficult. It can be.
It is similar to alcohol. And I know when we did the alcohol episode, I talked about this, that I used to run groups for people. And I keep thinking I want to run another group. But that after a while, I broke the group that I was running. And this was for lawyers and judges, lawyers, judges, and law students. And I broke it into two different groups after a while because I realized that there were some people that were really, really committed to recovery. They knew they had a problem. They knew they wanted to stop. And they were dealing with certain kinds of problems. There were another group of people that weren't sure if they had a problem or not. So it was a discovery group and then a recovery group. Mm-hmm. So the discovery, do I have a problem or not? How's my life going? And then recovery of like, okay, now I've stopped. Now what? And then I think there's another one like 5 years down the road that's uncovering, you know, what are my deepest issues? You know, so that's when you start talking about boundaries and attachment issues and, you know, codependency and all those kinds of things that are, how do we relate to other people in the world? And how do we kind of find the best self that you can possibly be and bring that out into the world? What do you want to have happen in your life? And I think that that's a powerful thing for people to recognize even fairly early on. It's like, what do you want your life to look like? I know we talk about one day at a time and all that stuff, but what do you want it to look like 5 years from now? What do you want to be doing? You know, because if you want to build a life that's worth showing up for, you don't want to give up something that you feel like this is the most important thing in my life. Now, where am I? There's going to be something else that replaces it that's bigger than you, that's going to be more powerful, that's going to be worth showing up for. And trying to get to that is so important.
Somebody said to me one time, and I always have to think about it, but are you changing your goals to match your behavior, or are you changing your behavior to match your goals? And so sometimes when people are stuck, you know, they settle for less. They're changing their goals. Well, I don't really need to go to college, or, you know, this is fine. I used to want to do X, Y, and Z, but I'm really doing okay. Or are you able to, you know, change and alter your behavior to meet where it is you want to go? And that's a pretty good barometer of mental health and maybe a relationship with the substance.
Well, that was one of the big things for me, was that I was out of undergrad, and I thought, well, I'm going to work for a year in the field. That's when I started working at St. Lawrence. And then next year I'll go to graduate school. And that became 5 years. And it was 5 years later, and I just realized I was just spinning my wheels. And like, why am I not doing the thing that I said I was going to do? What's keeping me from doing that? Mm-hmm. And I had to look at my substance use, really. That was a big part of it.
Yeah.
Or maybe the main part of it. Hmm. So, you know, biology trumps, what is it? Chemistry trumps psychology.
I don't know. Yeah, Why, in what way? I'm thinking in an academic class way. Chemistry versus psychology versus...
Well, not in an academic class, but just in terms of no matter what you feel like you want to do, you know, what your internal drive is, if your chemistry setup is such a, is such that you can't muster that access those resources that you know that are inside of you, there's something that's eclipsing that. And that's invariably a substance that you're ingesting in some way, or that's some kind of trauma that you're exposing yourself to. Like a really bad relationship will do that too.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking, you know, for clients that I'm working with, and they do have depression or you know, a mood disorder of some sort, and we've tried a number of medications, and they don't seem to be helping, and the person is using a substance that they... and a lot of times there's a there can be a protection there, you know, like it's helping me, it's helping my mood, it's helping, it's the only thing that makes me feel better. Then we have some talks about whether or not that is really true. You know, is the substance helping you, or is it kind of keeping you mired in the place that you're in? And that can be a really challenging and difficult conversation.
Yeah.
And then I send them to see you.
And the state of readiness. Yeah, well, the state of readiness whether they're
that goes back, right.
Look at that or not.
It's very hard to work with pre-contemplation. I mean, you know, in the professional sense, I mean, the idea is to, if there is, you know, if somebody is using heavily, they have a mood disorder, the depression is really persistent and unresponsive to treatment, then I'm starting to, you know, I'm thinking that the marijuana has something to do with that. But the person doesn't think that. And so I'm trying as a professional to help cultivate the possibility in their minds that that could be a thing to help to move things.
It's really all you can do. And the dilemma in therapy sometimes, I mean, just always reminding yourself, this is not my therapy. This is your therapy.
Yeah.
And what do you want to have happen? And I know some things, you know, I can put it out there and say, well, you know, this might be an element here. What do you think about that? But if they're discarding that, at least you're building a relationship with the client. They have a sense of like, this is a helpful person. This is a person who knows me pretty well. I can come to them and talk about this. And then over some time, you know, you can say, gosh, it seems like we've talked about this for a long time now. And I've wondered about, you know, would you like to try an experiment even of like, what if you stopped using for a month? You can always go back to it. You can always do that. But what if you try to stop for a period of time? If that's too long, how about a week? What if you stop for a week just to see what that's like for you? You know, just...
Yeah.
And sometimes people are like, okay, I'll try that. I've had people try that and then come back and say, you know what? I tried to stop for a week. I couldn't stop for 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, and then it was hard for them not to say, I think I'm dependent on it. You know, I think I am completely addicted in a way that I didn't know that I was. And, you know, then, you know, what's that like for you to kind of explore that?
I was thinking...
Long silence.
everybody contemplates.
There's contemplation space.
Well, I was thinking of that, you know, which we've kind of talked about, but this idea that that marijuana cannot be a problem, that it's a natural substance, that it is, you know, nature's medicine, that it, you know, sometimes there's just a really uphill battle to even... you know, kind of get an inroad into talking about it, you know, as a potential negative, you know, thing in somebody's life. That can be such a difficult conversation.
A Psychodelicious conversation is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is no substitute for therapy and should not be treated as such. If you feel a need for real therapy, you should consult your local provider, Google therapy or therapists in your area, check with community mental health or a suicide hotline if you are feeling suicidal.
Mike and Morgan welcome your questions, feedback, or dilemmas. Feel free to send us an email at apsychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com. That is a psychodelicious, psychodeliciousconversation conversation@gmail.com.
The views expressed on this podcast are solely the opinions of Mike Stratton and Morgan Bowen, and do not reflect the views or opinions of any site broadcasting this podcast. Replication of this podcast without written permission is strictly prohibited. This is LCC Connect.
Voices. Vibes.
Vision.
The LCC Library empowers the Lansing community to learn, teach, and discover. Located on the second and third floors of the Technology and Learning Center at the corner of Capitol and Shiawassee on LCC's downtown campus, the LCC Library's ambient spaces are available to the public for work, study, or quiet personal projects. In addition, those with memberships at collaborating libraries are free to check out materials from the LCC Library's collections. For more information, visit lcc.edu/library.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices,
Vibes, and Vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.